accession number 19104, Reel 2.
Major Brown, Reel 2.
It was a principle of flying with Osters that you didn't fly armed. The pilot carried his own personal weapon, but there was no fixed weapon on the aircraft. And indeed, as far as I know, until we got the bomb racks, which carried our flares, no officer had ever carried arms, although at times we would very much have liked to.
Why were you so keen on having arms?
I think because we got a little upset when people shot at us. And we couldn't do anything else back except wave a pistol at them.
Can you describe the instances that you remember of having ground fire?
Not in Malaya, although in fact I did have a hole through my engine canopy in Malaya, and that could only have come from a bullet from the ground. But certainly in Korea we had holes in the fuselage.
We'll come on to Korea a bit later.
Yes, but certainly in Malaya there were one or two.
Any incidents that happened to you during your period in the Millennium Emergency that you can recount, please?
Yes, since I was flying from squadron headquarters to Benta, which meant climbing over the top of the mountain range and then going down the other side. And there was a period in which you were not in radio contact either with Kuala Lumpur or with your flight base. And I was flying one of the ground staff back and the propeller stopped going round. Luckily, there was a large strip, a place called Bentong, and we did a dead stick landing on Bentong, which then left us some 6 miles away from the village and in what was classified as black country. That is to say, it was owned by the bandits and troops only came in and went out again. He stayed on the strip underneath the aircraft with his rifle. I went over to the road and luckily found a three-tonner filled with Gurkhas. They surrounded the aircraft, put me in the three-tonner, and I went to Bentong. Another aircraft came in and we repaired and went home.
What's a dead stick landing?
That's when there's no power on the propeller. The propeller just goes round and round and round, but there's no power.
Do you know which year this would have been in about?
This would have been before I went to Korea, so it must have been 52.
What had gone wrong?
A small piece of crankshaft had cracked and jammed the engine.
Was that anybody's fault?
Oh, no. It was just one of those things. It just unfortunately happened in an area where I couldn't call and tell anybody that it happened.
Any other incidents you recollect?
Not at that stage in Malaya, no. The other incidents are up in Korea, and when I came back to Malaya, it was the second time.
But any incidents from the second time in Malaya?
From the second time in Malaya, yes, I think I did a bombing raid with some Lincolns east, north of Butterworth, a night operation. And we blew a very large hole out of the jungle, which looked very, very impressive. The ground troops went in, followed up the next morning, And it was quite obvious that there had been people there and that a camp had been damaged. It was a successful operation. 7 months later, the ground troops captured a man who had actually been in the camp when the bombing took place. And he said that they'd become quite used over the time to hear the Oster, which they recognised as a sound, coming over low, and they knew, therefore, that something was going to happen. And when they saw the flare go down in the lodge in the trees, they knew where the bombs were going to hit. So they now stood absolutely still and listened for the sound of the big aeroplanes. When they'd located the sound of the big aeroplanes, they went and stood, so they put a tree between themselves and the sound, so that when the bombs fell, they would knock the trees down. The trees would cover them, so they wouldn't get hurt. I often thought that how much it must have cost to blow that big hole out of the jungle, and yet somebody down there had already worked out the way to defeat me.
What did you think to that tactic?
Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. The ground troops kept going in on these eggs and always said that it was an absolute mess. The big trees had come down and the small bamboos had crossed over, you know, and nobody could possibly have gotten out had they actually been there, but you see, they certainly could.
And your role in the Oster in that operation?
Was to drop the marker flare on which formed the bottom of the bombing run.
And which year would this have been in?
That would have been 54, 55.
Any other incidents you recollect?
Well, in 1954, the chief of police of Kedah was killed in ambush on Kedah Peak, and Kedah Peak is a mountain immediately opposite the island of Penang, north of Butterworth. At that stage, HMS Belfast was sitting at anchor off Georgetown on a courtesy visit, and it was thought a good thing if she was used to stir up the bandits who were obviously still on top of Kedah Peak. I was at Butterworth at the time, doing some reconnaissance work, and I was invited to go and shoot the guns of Belfast onto the top of Kedah Peak. As far as I can remember, I shot a turret most successfully.
You shot what?
I shot a turret, the forward turret. What I didn't realise until very much later, and I should have thought about it, was that, of course, Belfast was used to engaging ships with that turret, and therefore she was firing from sea to sea. I think Kedah Peak, the point we were firing at, was about 2,000 feet above sea level. And so her firing table was totally useless. As far as I know, talking to the gunnery officer at the time, the whole of the chute was worked out on the back of a player's cigarette packet by basic mathematics. And the table was absolutely dead. But it was a very successful shoot.
The table was absolutely dead?
Dead, yes. They couldn't use it at all because they couldn't put that height in.
What kind of shot was being used?
I think they were using the six inch 80. It was quite an impressive shoot. We blew lots of tree trees down.
And what did you do yourself?
I merely flew my Oster and directed their fire.
Now, you haven't said anything about the detail of the supply drops.
Supply drops were to people in deep jungle. The operations on the ground were based upon the fact that people went into the jungle and stayed in. And if they wanted supplies, then they would cut a small clearing, put up smoke, and we would go in and drop supplies for them. These could either be free-fall packages or packages on parachutes. With the Osta, if you take the radio out, you can probably get 4 or 5 parachute drops set beside Hydra. Then you just push them out of the door. So Michael Hickey, who you know, spent, I think, 3 days supplying the police into Thailand, doing nothing except going in, dropping, coming back, dropping.
How did you like doing this work?
It made you concentrate a great deal. Of course, you knew that if you missed, certainly with the parachute would then hang up in the trees, and the trees were probably 250 foot high, and so you then lost the supplies. One incident, in fact, from Benta in Pahang. I didn't do the drop, but I flew as a support for the drop. I think it was the second KR had a casualty on the ground, and so they cut a clearing for the helicopter to come in and casivac the man. They could do everything except for one very, very tall dead tree. So they sent out a request for a power saw, and this was dropped in by a Valletta. And just their luck, the parachute landed on top of the tree that they wanted to cut down. So in fact, they sent a man up the tree to cut the thing down. And to their horror, he got up there, he went along the branch, he then climbed down the shrouds of the parachute and stood on the saw and cut the shrouds. Then they had 2 casualties on the ground, the man who'd been injured in the battle and the man who'd fallen down the tree. He, I believe, was unconscious for something like 5 or 6 months.
So, who would be the crew of an Osta normally?
Just one. The pilot. There's a picture one up there. There, in fact, this was my squadron. And that is an Osta 9. Very much like the Osta 6 that I flew. Normally just you yourself.
So what about the packages? How were they?
Well, if you look there, that one there has got its door on beside the pilot. So if you take the opposite door off, you then have an open space. And if you stack the packages right, you can just push them out. For a parachute drop, you tie static lines on the inside of the aircraft, and then you push the package out, and the static line opens the chute when it's clear of the airplane.
What was the Osta like to fly?
Very nice indeed. I think I said before, a simple aeroplane. Very suited to jungle work, because the strips were literally just holes cut in the jungle with large trees at either end. And an Osta was light enough and powerful enough to jump out over the trees.
Did the enemy ever try to attack the airstrips or sabotage the aircraft?
As far as I know, no. No, no stage.
Why not?
I don't actually know. We certainly never had a high concentration of troops around our strips. Not even in Benta, which was a real jungle strip. We didn't have a lot of troops spread around. I don't actually know. Perhaps they got more information by letting us do our job than they would have done if they'd have tried to take us out.
What were your living conditions like in Malaya?
In Benta, we lived in tents or in huts. In Taiping, it was very luxurious. We actually lived in Taiping Town. In Kuala Lumpur, of course, it was luxurious again. Seremban was again a jungle-type strip, but Singapore, of course, was a town.
Were you happy in Malaya? Or?
Oh yeah, I love Malaya. Yes.
What was the nature of the people in the squadron?
All very, very young, very enthusiastic. Young enough, I think, to enjoy what they were doing at that time. I'm not sure I'd say the same thing about Korea, but certainly Malaya.
So you don't think it would have worked so well if they had been older?
No, I don't. I think they needed to be that particular age, in their lower 20s, when they didn't believe anything could happen to them. And this allowed them, therefore, to go deep in the jungle or go into a difficult clearing or something.
So older men would have been too cautious?
I think so, yes.
So Korea, you've suggested, was sandwiched in between two Malaya sessions.
Yes, the policy of the squadron was to provide pilots for 1903 Independent Aero Peace Squad flight that was in the Korean campaign. And that particular flight was a mixture. It had Australian and Canadian pilots as well as British.
And it was called 1903 Independent
AOP flight.
So how many were in a flight?
In this particular flight, let me see, there were 7 aircraft. There was a flight commander and 6.
And this was officers as well?
Yes. We had Oster 6s. We had 1 Oster 7, which was a dual control for liaison work.
Where was this flight based in Korea?
The flight was based on the banks of the Imjin, right outside the Commonwealth Brigade headquarters. It was a paddy field that had been bulldozed in a bend in the Imjin River.
So it didn't have the name of a Korean settlement?
No.
When approximately would you have been in Korea then?
I went up to Korea in the beginning of 53, and I was up there until 54.
So after the armistice?
No, I went up there before the armistice.
But you left after the armistice?
Oh, yeah, left after the armistice, yes.
How did you view leaving Malaya for Korea?
Well, I wanted to because I knew that I had to go to Korea at some stage. The sooner I went, the better. Because I didn't get back to the Malayan squadron early enough. My wife and family could not come out and join me on that tour. So I was quite happy to go to Korea whenever I could.
What did you find when you got to this Commonwealth HQ?
We were living in tents on the edge of the strip. The aircraft were all inside their own mortar-proof shelters. It was very cold. Coming from Malaya, where it had been nice and warm, it was very definitely a cultural shock.
And what kind of work were you put on to start off with?
Immediately went straight. We flew at least one aircraft during daylight hours actually over the front, shooting.
Shooting?
Yes, we were given targets by a brigade headquarters, and we also had regiments of field guns allotted to us. And then we did our job as AOP pilots, which was to fly our airplane and shoot the guns in onto the targets.
So, can you tell me how you would communicate with the guns, what you would say to them?
Yeah, we had a radio link. We carried an HF radio with us that linked us directly into the guns. And we first of all gave the guns the map reference of the target. They logged it in onto their gunnery boards. They then fired a round for us. We observed the fall of the round relative to the target, which we could then see. We then gave them corrections on their fall or the fall of shot. They altered their guns, and we took them on the targets.
So what form would the corrections take?
Oh, we dropped the range in hundreds of yards or in 25 yards, and then we altered the bearings by, again, yards.
How did the system work out?
Extremely well. Extremely well. It was totally different. We had next to us the our equivalent in the American side, who were flying L-19 aircraft. But their pilots were only allowed to tell the guns where the shot had gone. The guns made the correction. On our side, we told the guns where to correct. Which seemed to work very much better.
And what kind of height were you flying in Korea?
Oh, anywhere between 500 and 5,000 feet.
And what could you see of the enemy positions from that height?
Oh, a lot. Most of our work, the targets had already been found by somebody else. We were then given map references and descriptions of the targets. During the hours of daylight, we flew out, found the target on the ground. We then allotted a battery of guns, and we then shot the guns onto those targets. In general terms, we had one aircraft in the air continuously from dawn until dusk, engaged on pre-selected targets. And then if any other target appeared whilst you were in your standard shoot, you could then call on guns to fire those, such as troop movements on the ground, vehicles on the ground.
But was it normally just trench systems that you were firing at?
A lot of it was trench systems, yes. The North Koreans were very, very good at going from one side of a hill and burrowing their way right through the hill and coming out with little observation posts on the front side, or gun positions on the front side. And so we used, amongst other things, the Americans had a 240mm shell which had a fuse delay on it, which went down to the ground about 65 feet before it exploded. And we used that quite a lot. Zeroing in with ordinary shells and then putting them right down into the ground and exploding them.
You said North Koreans. Were they North Koreans or Chinese?
North Koreans. I suppose they were under Chinese. We regard them as North Koreans.
And what about ground fire that you experienced?
Again, I had one or two holes.
Nothing more?
Not really, no. I had a large piece of metal, again, came off an engine cowling, which meant that I came in an emergency landing. I got quite a lot thrown at me on one particular occasion because I was going after what later proved to be a headquarters that again had been burrowed through the hill. And I was sent out to do it when the cloud was very low. And so in order to be able to see, I had to fly below the cloud. I suppose about 800 feet. And I was trapped between the ground and 800 feet. And although I heard some of it, a few holes, people on the ground told me a lot was coming up at me, but obviously they missed me.
Would you be able to see individual enemy?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, as I once engaged a man who was walking down a road with a bullock cart. And the only reason I engaged him was that it was in an area where I had never, ever seen a man before. And it was strange that the bullock cart was going towards the front. Right in the far distance, you often saw bullock carts going along farm tracks. It's the first time I'd ever seen a bullock cart actually going towards the front. And I had nothing else to do, so I engaged him with one gun. And he came round the corner just in time to meet a 25-pounder shell, whereupon the whole of his bullock cart disintegrated. He was carrying ammunition supplies up to the front.
You said that some of your brother officers were hit and brought down.
Yes, the reason that we went up, that I went up to Korea, was that the previous Australian pilot had been hit and, in fact, died trying to get his aircraft back onto the strip at beside the engine. He got as far as the strip, but then went out of control, went across the Imjin River and crashed into the bluff on the other side and was killed. And that was why, in fact, I moved from Malaya up. The chap who took over as flight commander, Wolf Harris, who was going to be the new squadron commander of the squadron in Malaya at the end of his tour, in fact, was killed on Coronation Day. On the strip, he went back in his jeep down the side of the strip. At the same time, an American jet that had lost its engine and flamed out came in to make an emergency landing, spun sideways, and of all things hit his jeep and killed him.
How did incidents like this affect morale?
I think that one hit us very badly indeed, because it was on Coronation Day. We had declared there would be no fighting that day as far as we were concerned. As far as all the Commonwealth did was concerned, there would be no fighting that day. And this was one of those stupid accidents.
I think you told me earlier off the record that you didn't like it as much in Korea as in Malaya.
No, I didn't. I couldn't think of a very good reason for being there. I think a very good reason for being in Malaya. When I got to Korea, I knew I was going up there to fight with the Commonwealth. But I found the campaign was almost like trench warfare of World War I. It was bogged right down. There didn't seem to be a great deal of point to it. And then we had the exercise at Panmunjom when peace came. We then had this zone applied. And for them,